that one, stop it up here.
That's when you came in, that's 15, and they have eight other items on the agenda, and we went back to the current public. Two more hours.
Is that PC or VOS?
It was,
Oh, we're still, there.
Squeeze in. All right, I think we're gonna make all of our sales.
Okay.
All right.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Travis got us a new toy. A pointer has a clicker.
No, I got a right hand man.
Right? Excellent.
I
Not your problem. Impact document. All right, we gotta get this show on. Welcome to the regular meeting of the San Bernardino City Planning Commission. Please place your phones on vibrate or silence so it doesn't disturb the meeting. Commissioner Earp, would you lead us in a flag salute, please? Thank you. Would you call the roll?
Chair Heasley?
Present.
Vice Chair Durr? Commissioner Machen?
Here.
Commissioner Lopez?
Here.
Commissioner Ebley?
Here.
Commissioner Gallagher?
Here.
Commissioner Earp?
Here.
Commissioner Jones?
Here.
Commissioner Quill? Commissioner Durr is excused. Commissioner Quill absent. We have quorum.
Thank you. Anybody wishing to speak tonight has to be sworn in, so Ms. Perez, would you administer the oath?
Please stand and raise your right hand for those that are speaking. Do you solemnly affirm that the testimony you are about to give before this body will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? If so, please say, I do. Thank you. You may be seated.
Thank you. Consent items are considered routine in nature and may be enacted in one motion. All public and non-public hearings will be opened at one time. Any item may be discussed separately upon a request of a member of the Planning Commission or a member of the public. What does staff recommend for the consent agenda?
Thank you, Chair and Commissioners. We have four items on tonight's consent calendar. The first one are approval of the minutes from January 18th, 2017. Second item, actually items 2, 3, and 4 all deal with street vacations in the area of Home Avenue and I Street. And those are all noted as item number 2 is real property street vacation 16-0008. Item 3 is real property street vacation 16-00010. And item number 4 is real property street vacation 16-000-11. Staff is recommending approval of all four items on the consent calendar.
Anybody wishing to pull any of the items that are on the consent agenda, either the public or commissioners? I have one condition I'd like to place on item number 2 and 4 because they tie together. And that is that we have a confirmed required routing for the traffic that'll be using that property. Any concerns, Mr. Graham?
Looking at 2 and 4, they appear to be before the Planning Commission for a general or for an interpretation of the Planning Commission. They're not seeking an entitlement. The street vacation action itself would need to be conducted by the mayor and common council, not the planning commission. What I would recommend is that condition that you are requesting be forwarded as a recommendation to the mayor and common council to impose as part of the actual street vacation and not as part of your interpretation of general plan consistency. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and we can certainly do that, commissioners, if you have Chair Heasley did you have a particular direction of the trucks, or is it somewhere the trucks shouldn't go?
I believe the direction would be to confirm all their traffic to Reese Street, and I believe the north-south street then would be Montgomery.
So as the city attorney has suggested, we can certainly add that as a condition to the street vacation, which is an action that the city council would actually be taking. This is just a general plan consistency finding that vacating these three street segments wouldn't negatively impact the general plan. But the actual approval of the vacation, as Mr. Graham has said, would be done by the council.
Okay, so the recommendation will go to the council for their purview for approval or denial?
That is correct, yes. And we will, at that time, suggest to the Public Works Department that be made a condition, and that was requested by the Planning Commission.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion to either approve the consent items as modified by Director. I have a motion to approve. Do I have a second? And we have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Now we're going to go with our public hearing items. The Planning Commission will first hear a report from staff, then the public hearing will be opened. The applicant will have an opportunity to speak. Next, members of the public will be allowed 3 minutes to speak. Anyone in the audience wishing to speak must be sworn in and also fill out a request to speak form. The forms are located on a table near the door. When your name is called, come forward and speak into the microphone. Say and spell your name and give your address for the taped record. After all is spoken, the applicant will be allowed to respond. The public hearing will be closed, and the Planning Commission will then begin deliberations and make a decision. All actions except general plan amendments and amendments to the Municipal Development Code are final action unless an appeal is filed and a fee paid within 15 days to the Community Development Department. If you challenge the resultant action of the Planning Commission in court, you may be limited to raising only those issues you or someone else raised at the public hearing described in this agenda or in written correspondence delivered to the Community Development Department at or prior to the public hearing. Item number 5.
Good evening, Mary Blaze, contract planner. Item number 5 is a conditional use permit, 1621. And it is a request to allow the development, establishment, and operation of a drive-through automated car wash containing about 4,608 square feet, along with the required on-site and off-site improvements on a parcel that's just over an acre in size. This slide is an aerial location map. The site is shaded in red. It is on West Frontage Road, just north of East Highland Avenue. This is a slide showing the zoning. The site is highlighted in black. It's zoned commercial general 1, as is the surrounding properties. The process timeline is the application was submitted September 26, 2016. It went to DERC on December 8th, 2016 for an informal review. At that time, the DERC asked for a traffic study and for a water quality plan, and the applicant prepared those and resubmitted. Staff looked at those, and it went back to DERC on January 26, 2017, and the DERC moved the categorical exemption and the project to Planning Commission. February 1st, a legal advertisement was sent to the Sun. February 4th, the ad was published and notices were mailed to surrounding property owners within 500 feet. The property is 1 acre in size, roughly. It's triangular shaped. It's vacant except for a small area in the north of the site that has a cell tower on it currently. It's surrounded by commercial general zoning. The proposal is to construct a one-story building, 4,608 square feet. It will house an automated conveyor car wash. It'll contain small office space and a mezzanine storage area. They're also proposing landscaping, lighting, surface parking. They're going to secure the site with perimeter wrought iron fencing. They'll have ADA accessible parking, and there'll be a sliding security gate near the driveway entrance. The project meets or exceeds the CG1 development code standards. They're proposing a high-quality architectural design building, which we'll look at in a second, and which will be compatible with the existing surrounding uses. This is the site plan. It shows the general layout. The building is towards the east, southeast of the site. There's access will occur at an existing shared driveway that's near the Chevron site. They'll pull into a designated drive aisle. They'll pull up to a pay kiosk. They will which has an arm guard. Once they pay, they'll be able to continue through to the car wash, and a conveyor will pull the car through. When they exit the car wash, they have the opportunity to use a self-serve vacuuming station, or they can exit the site where they came in. Landscaping, they're proposing perimeter landscaping, trees, shrubs, a combination of material to shade the site and make it more compatible with existing surrounding development. This is the floor plan. It shows that most of the area in the building is used for the car wash, conveyor, and the equipment. They do have a small office space and some storage, as I said earlier. And then, as I said earlier also, the perimeter fencing is going to be the security metal fence that you see in this slide to keep the property secure during non-business hours. This is an elevation of the canopy. It's pretty state-of-the-art. It has a fabric canopy top, and you can see that the vacuum hoses are integrated into the canopy structure, so it looks like a real seamless a look. Building elevations, this is north and south, east and west. West is going to be, that's the elevation that would face frontage. East would be facing 330. And these next few slides show the existing conditions. This is looking north from Highland Avenue. This is looking south from State Route 330. That large pine tree is the existing cell tower in the corner of the site. This is looking north from Frontage Road, east from Frontage Road, and this is looking north from State Route 330. This is the shared driveway that currently exists that is going to be used to access the site off of Frontage Road. So we are recommending that the Planning Commission adopt Resolution 2017-12, adopting the categorical exemption and approving CUP 1621 based on the findings of fact and conditions of approval. And I'm available for questions. I think the applicant is also here.
Thank you. Commissioners, have any questions for staff? No. Are there any concerns by the commissioners that we need to have a presentation by the owner? I have one speaker slip, and that is the owner's. If he has anything he'd like to address.
I'm just here for questions.
Any questions for the owner? At this time, then I'll entertain a motion.
I'd like to make a motion to approve adopt resolution number 2017-012 based on the findings of fact and subject to a conditions of approval. 16-21.
I have a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
I have a second by Commissioner Machen. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Unanimous. Item number six.
Item number six is conditional use permit 1629. Sorry. Wrong way. New toy, sorry. The conditional use permit is a request to modify a previously approved conditional use permit 89-47 for an existing veterinary hospital to add overnight animal boarding and just modernize and update their facility. They're located at 939 West 40th Street within the Commercial General CG1 zone and Transit Overlay District, the TD zone. You can see they're right at the corner of 40th and F, just off of a little bit east of Kendall Drive. Currently, the property is surrounded by a flood channel to the south and west. There's churches across the street to the east, and then a little bit of residential and commercial mixed in across the street to the north on 40th, located within the county. The proposed project would modify the previously approved conditional use permit for the veterinary hospital, as previously stated. The project would actually occur in three phases. Phase one and two would occur basically in succession, and then phase three would occur later as additional space is required for the business. The property is, I don't know if the commissioners are familiar with this veterinary hospital, but it's been there for a very long time, so it needs a little bit of updating. So we'll see in a few slides that they are modernizing as well as adding additional space to their facility. So in phase one, you can see, there we go. Okay, this is the current building right here. It's much smaller than the building that they're proposing, but they'd like to keep that while they're under construction. The new building, which will be on the east, northeast side of the property, is currently occupied by overflow parking. So that building will be under construction while they're still in business. Then phase two of the project, they'll demolish the existing building and upgrade the parking lot in that area and add some additional parking. Phase three, as I said, which would occur a little bit in the future, they're expecting in about 5 years, they'll be upgrading their facility. VCA is a chain throughout the nation. They have several in California already. They recently purchased this hospital, so they will be upgrading the site. They do plan on eventually hiring another doctor and a few more of their regular employees, and so the additional space will be needed at that time. So you can see they're going with a really fresh, modern look, nice and clean lines. Definitely a little bit different from what's there now. As you can see, this is the building looking basically from 40th Street. So it is a little bit outdated. And this is the south side of the property. Again, most of this will be utilized for parking and the trash enclosure, the new trash enclosure. The Planning Commission, Planning Division recommendation is that the Planning Commission adopt Resolution 2017-013, adopting the categorical exemption pursuant to Section 15301 for existing facilities, and approving conditional use permit 16-29 based on the findings of fact and subject to the conditions of approval.
Thank you. Commissioner Gallo.
Are the overnight stays inside or is it outside?
They will be inside. Yes, everything is completely enclosed.
You stated they expect in 5 years to have all three phases completed?
Yes, and the third phase is fairly minor comparatively. It's about another 500 to 800 square feet at the most. And the first two phases will be completed in succession as quickly as they can get those done.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for staff? Commissioner Lopez.
You may have mentioned it and I missed it. For how, since this is overnight, for how many animals are they building this to house?
I don't think that we actually have that information.
Is the applicant present?
They are not. The architect is actually out of state, so they were not able to be here for the meeting tonight. I don't think they state, but they have...
And is this mostly for dogs and cats, or is this other animals?
I believe it's mostly dogs and cats. There may be a few various other animals.
They would be housed indoors so that
parking at
night is not going to be an issue for the neighbors.
Yeah, their site plan shows, or actually the floor plan shows the different areas within the structure that will house cats and then obviously a separate room for dogs. And they don't have any additional space for other animals, so I'm guessing that that is not something that they're planning on specializing in.
So they're basically a small animal veterinary.
They are currently, and they plan to remain small, but just a little bit larger than what they are now. They would like to eventually become a 24-hour emergency clinic because the closest one that we have is in Grand Terrace.
So I was
sorry.
Small animals, not small building.
Small animals. Yes, small animals. Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Small animals.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're not going to have horses
floating
and
through
cows. And
that's correct.
Okay.
And so this requires 24-hour staffing.
It will eventually. They're not going to be there initially, but that is the plan to eventually become a 24-hour emergency. Clinic, and I imagine that the after normal business hours, the staff will be relatively minimal.
And this, my next question might be for the director, is with the rewrite or modification of our development folder that we're in process with, will this type facility be impacted by anything in the development code, if they wish to expand to our large animal practice as well?
Well, first of all, I'll have Travis answer the question about the development code update because he's kind of leading that effort. But I was going to suggest that it might be good for the Planning Commission to, if they move to approve this tonight, add a few conditions that it be limited to small animals, because that is a pretty clearly defined term among veterinary hospitals, and also the condition that there be no outdoor boarding of animals. I don't think there's an issue that we would have with boarding. It just would be the outdoor boarding, as Commissioner Lopez has noted. Obviously, animals outdoors, especially dogs overnight, can be a problem. So I would suggest those as a couple of conditions, and then all.
There's very little residential right in the area. There's some across 40th, but other than that, the property is completely contained by the flood control channel and 40th Street and F Street, and then you've got a church basically to the east of that property. And 40th Street there is probably at least 80 feet to 100 feet wide. So I don't know, even if they were to propose outdoor boarding, that would really be much of an issue for people in the area.
Mr. Geller.
I think it would be an issue. It just across the street on 40th, even though those on the frontage part of that, immediately behind them is all residential. And when you have outside boarding that many, it doesn't take very many for that noise to carry very far. So us adding that as a condition really
I don't think that they would have an issue with that. So.
Okay.
And as Travis just pointed out, there's frankly no room. There will be no room to do that once they are completed with their phases. So.
So we're.
But we can add that.
Just to answer the other question. Right now, and I'm not sure if you're questioning, are there going to be standards for veterinary uses specifically, or whether their processing type will change? So I'll try to answer both. Under the current proposal with the new code, and with the understanding that everything is still in process. In areas that would still be zoned, not CG1 with the name changing, but the equivalent zoning, it would still be allowed to have overnight boarding with the conditional use permit. So if this application came forward in a year, it would be the same item being presented in front of you under the same process. In industrial areas, it would just be, currently we're not proposing the conditional use permit. I believe that is the standard in the current code as well. And there, we've reserved a section for standards for veterinary uses, or for specifically for animal boarding, not if it's just a vet's office, but they don't keep animals on premise. But those standards haven't been drafted just yet. So certainly we can, I think I have the notes of the commission now, and we can definitely address issues regarding animals outdoors, and just make that a standard in the code that they can't be doing outdoor boarding. Possibly at least within a certain distance of residential, or just outright. But we'll work to put something together, and then when we bring it back forward to the commission, we can go through that like we did previously at the last study session.
Thank you. That helps. In the interim, what I would suggest is that we have the two conditions. One is it's restricted to a small animal practice facility, and that there is no outdoor boarding of animals.
I have those.
Added to it?
Yes.
Actually, Chair, if I may, Mr. Graham and I were just looking in the municipal code under, I think it would probably be better to reference companion animals, which are a defined term in the code under Chapter 6.01.020L, which is animal keeping, because we do have an animal shelter. Companion animals are defined, and it's what you would expect for small dogs, cats.
I can read the definition if the commission would prefer.
I'd like to interject. My companion animal is my horse.
That would not fall under the definition of a companion animal in our code.
Okay.
But I'll read it to you. A companion animal means any domestic or feral dog, domestic or feral cat, non-human primate, guinea pig, hamster, rabbit not raised for human food or fiber, exotic or native animal, reptile, exotic or native bird, or any animal under the care, custody, ownership of a person, or any animal which is bought, sold, traded, or bartered by any person, agricultural animals, game species, or any animals regulated under federal law as research animals are not considered companion animals for the purposes of this title. A horse would likely fall under the definition of livestock, which includes bovine, equine, ovine, and many other ines. cattle, horse, sheep, pigs, deer, goats.
So pet ostriches. Pigs are not going to qualify. Those little pigs that people walk around on leashes?
Right. So a pig would not fall.
I'm just trying to understand it all.
That's fair.
I'm concerned that in the future our definitions may not be adequate to meet what we need to have to make sure that we cover the basis, so to speak. Because the coverage are pretty good, but I see a lot of these little, I don't know what kind of pigs they are, little tiny pigs that they run around and they have them on leashes.
Sure.
Pet pigs.
So we're going to the definitions that are contained in Title VI of the city's municipal code, which are related to animals. Under the city's code, pigs are not considered companion animals, though they are certainly friendly and adorable.
What was the intent of the applicant when they implied? I mean, was there specialty dog and cat, or did they say small animals?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'll let Chantal look at that. Unfortunately, the engineer who was the project applicant called late this afternoon and said that they had a conflict. And said they would not be able to attend. So we will attempt to answer that question. But, yeah, they did apologize, and we still felt that it was appropriate to bring the item forward if the commission's comfortable with what we can answer. If not, this can certainly be continued until we can have the applicant here himself.
Well, I'm personally comfortable with the added conditions that we spoke of, and that would satisfy my concerns. Any other comments? Well, in that case, I'll ask for somebody to make a motion.
I'd like to make a motion adopting resolution 2017-013, adopting the categorical exemption and approving conditional use permit 16-29 based on findings of fact and subject to recommended conditions of approval, including the two provisions in regards to the small animal provision and the indoor housing of animals as well.
I have a motion. Do I have a second?
A second.
I have a second.
Just to clarify before you vote, when you say small animal, do we mean companion animal as we just discussed? Or great? Okay. Thank you.
Should we have that terminology on the condition that it's a companion animal?
I would recommend that, because small animal is not defined anywhere. Companion animal is.
Okay. That suits with you, Mr. Alrighty. I have a motion, and it's good with you on the second?
Yes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Unanimous. Item number 7.
No, the other one.
Welcome, Commissioner
Quill. Item number 7 is General Plan Amendment 16-01, Development Code Amendment 16-01, Specific Plan 16-01, Subdivision 16-02 for Tentative Parcel Map 19701, and Subdivision 16-03 for Tentative Tract Map 20006 for the Rancho Palma specific plan. If you remember, we briefly went over the specific plan in the middle of December. It's located near Palm and Little League, up on near the Verdemont Heights community. Currently, the entire property, other than the small piece of flood channel, is zoned commercial general CG1. The general plan amendment and zoning changes would allow for some residential uses and some additional park space, as well as commercial. When the project is built, the specific plan guidelines will allow a maximum build-out of 120 residential units and approximately 98,000 square feet of commercial uses. The purpose of this specific plan was to create a connected, walkable, mixed-use neighborhood with lots of recreational space and easy movement between the residential neighborhood and the commercial site. For the processing of this project, a notice of preparation was circulated on March 28, 2016, followed by a scoping meeting that was conducted on April 5, 2016. As a result of the notice of preparation and scoping meeting, the draft specific plan and environmental impact report were circulated for public review and comments on July 8 of 2016. We received comments and made our responses to those comments in January 12th of 2017. The DERC reviewed those documents and moved the project forward to the Planning Commission. So the specific plan has four cornerstone principles guiding the design and guidelines of this specific plan. So the city's heritage principle establishes a California-based theme and character using three different models of or specific types of architecture for the residential use, as well as drought-tolerant plant species and native plant species. The second cornerstone is to be neighborhood-centered and connect the residential neighborhood to the parks and commercial uses. The third cornerstone is to promote a green and healthy lifestyle, creating a walkable neighborhood and encouraging energy and water conservation. And the fourth principle is to be fiscally responsible, increasing the sales tax revenue with the commercial development and increasing the population to support those commercial uses. The final environmental impact report includes the public review draft environmental impact report and technical studies, the revised draft environmental impact report, the response to written comments, findings of fact for CEQA, and the mitigation monitoring program. It's just a sample of the way that the project will be broken up. Let me go back to that. Sorry, still getting used to this. Okay, so you can see that we're going from this entire location being zoned commercial general to allowing a mix of residential. The yellow will be slightly less dense than the orange area, but they will be similar. There's a portion of park area up towards the north end of the project that is going to be dedicated to the existing Ronald Reagan Park there. And it will also be developed with a little gazebo and walkway as part of the specific plan. There are several other pocket parks. There's a drainage basin. There will be an RV parking lot so that we won't have recreational vehicles just parked throughout and around the site. Another private park for the residences, and a walkway connecting these residential neighborhoods to the commercial project, which will include a grocery store, several inline retail shops, and a restaurant pad. The Planning Division's recommendation tonight is that the Planning Commission adopt resolution number 2017-014, forwarding a recommendation to the Mayor and City Council to certify the final environmental impact report and approve General Plan Amendment 16-01, Development Code Amendment, Zoning Map Amendment 16-01, Specific Plan 16-01, Subdivision 16-02 for tentative parcel map 19701, and Subdivision 16-03 for tentative tract map 20006 based on the findings of fact.
Thank you. Any questions for staff at this time? Commissioner Machen?
Yeah, would staff elaborate on what is meant by a walkable community?
Yes, I can elaborate a little bit, but I can also have the applicant come up in a moment. He has a presentation to make also. But a walkable community basically means that the residential portion will be relatively, not necessarily small lots, but certainly not excessively large lots, no estate type lots. So the residences will be somewhat dense. and you have it's basically contained a contained community, so it will be basically gated in with walking paths directly from the residential portion to the commercial center, so you don't necessarily have to get in your car to drive over to the commercial center or the grocery store. You can just walk if you'd prefer to do that. And then also lots of outdoor recreational areas like the private parks, the pocket park.
I have a question.
Commissioner Gallo?
In the environmental impact report, it indicated that the flood zoning for that area was originally assigned by, I think, the Army Corps of Engineers, and that it was a temporary, and maybe that's the wrong term to use, but that it could then be changed in the future. And so my question to you is, what's the likelihood that that would be changed? It did say that it was not, that area was not identified in the 100-year flood plan, but if it were to change in the future, what's the likelihood? What conditions exist that that would change and then it could be reassigned a different flood zone category after the development's constructed?
I'll have the applicant address that in just a moment, but it's my understanding that the guidelines have been crafted in such a way that once the project is designed and developed, it will account for any change in the flood zone categorization. Mark, would you
once
like to...
Once built, I don't know that you could do anything about reconstructing homes if it's the elevation isn't sufficient.
Okay. Ray Allard, Allard Engineering, representing the applicant. The after Katrina, levees throughout the United States had to go through a certification program. And Cable Creek in this vicinity, since the water level is higher than the ground next to it, is considered a levee and not a channel. The initial studies showed that the levee in this area could be decertified, meaning that it would have to be reinforced or fortified. We already have designs in place. We've met with flood control. We meet with them almost monthly on how to increase the channel carrying capacity and turn it into a certifiable levee through FEMA in the event it does become decertified. It's something that everybody's watching closely because it affects the houses to the north also if this levee becomes uncertified. Currently, the studies show that it won't pass muster, but flood control disagrees with the studies, and they've asked FEMA to take another look at the levee again.
Okay. Commissioner Lopez?
What is the square footage of the land itself where these houses are going to be built?
The square footage of the lots?
Mm-hmm.
There are two lot sizes. 5,000 square foot lots and 7,200 square foot lots. The average, I'd have to go to my map, but those are the lot sizes.
What is the size?
5,000 square foot lots and 7,200 square foot lots.
So, and the size of the house, what is the square footage of the houses that are going to be built on those two lots?
I can have the planner answer that, but that has not really been determined at this particular time. The builder would come in and set a variety of housing sizes.
They're going to be big houses?
They'll be appropriate houses.
What would be the asking price for these homes? I'm just saying the tendency seems to be smaller lots, big houses this way, and then people become concerned because their view is obstructed of, you know, people want to have views of the mountains and so forth and other things, and it seems like a lot of house and a small square footage.
Currently, we're just looking at this, the project itself doesn't actually include development at this time. It really is just the specific plan establishing guidelines for this specific area. When a developer does pick up this project, they will use these guidelines as a tool to direct them on how to design the project. But we will bring it back to the Planning Commission and review for all of those situations that may be of concern to the Planning Commission, including the size and density of the homes.
If I may, Commissioner,
Chair. Director?
The applicant might be able to answer some of these questions. As Chantal had noted, they do have a presentation, so maybe it would be appropriate for the applicant to make their presentation and then continue with questions if there are questions. And then I know that Melina has been trying to put a note in the record that Commissioner Quill did is now part of the commission, and he joined at 6:30 for item 7. So just that's in the record.
Thank you.
Additional question before. One more question.
Before the presentation, I'm asking staff for some additional. I'm not sure I got clarity on the answer in relationship to the potential decertification of that to change it to a different flood zone if that were to happen in the future. Do you have any additional thing to enlighten me? Once something is constructed, if they down the road change the flood zoning for that area and it's already constructed, and that new flood zoning would require the elevation of that building area to have been raised. Then
if I might interject here, Mark Teague, we prepared the environmental impact report that you were reading from that document. The way we addressed it in the environmental impact report is that the levee would have to be reconstructed. And we looked at first to see whether or not the project itself would impede the reconstruction of that levee. And because there's access from both ends of the project to be able to construct that levee, we determined that you could still, even once the project has been completed, get in there to do whatever repairs or reconstruction of the levee were necessary to get them back out of the floodplain. Okay. So the issue is one of money and access to the area to do the construction. The access is there. The money will have to figure itself out if they do decertify the letter.
I see.
Does that help?
That provides some more clarity. Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to invite the applicant to come up and give his presentation and be available for any other questions that come up. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chairman, fellow planning commissioners. So during the last 2 years, we've worked diligently with the neighbors.
Excuse me, could I get you to just state your name and address for the tape record, please? Thank you.
Yes, sir. Eric Flodine, representing Strata Palma, the landowner and applicant. So we worked with the neighbors, which I'll definitely get into in the presentation, city staff and our technical team. Now, before we began project design, we hired an expert in market analysis so that we could understand the current supply and future demand of housing and commercial in the city so that we could come up with the optimal land use plan, because nobody wants to design a project that's obsolete before you get to the finish line. So armed with that information, we move forward. This property is located along the I-215 and just near Palm Avenue. It's an infill property, as you can see from the aerial there, and it's surrounded by different residential areas of different size and character, as well as recreation and schools and commercial. So it really is an infill project surrounded by a mix of uses. The area, the community to the north and northeast of the project is the Verdamont area, the Verdamont Heights area. And before we began site planning, we were fortunate, largely at the direction of Councilman Nickel, to reach out to the Verdamont Neighborhood Association Board. And we bought this property in November of 2014. And just over a month later, I was able to meet with the board members of the VNA. I'll be saying VNA throughout this presentation to shorten it. Fortunately, the overall membership was having a meeting that same month. So on January 29th, I met with the overall membership, and it was a packed room. I'm guessing there were around 50 or more people there. And that was pre-site plan. So all I had there that night was an aerial and a bunch of large notepad boards just to write notes, and took in their inputs on requests and concerns and visions for the area and any ideas for future site design. So armed with that and the site character and our market analysis, we went to work. So a few months later, in May of 2015, met again with the overall membership and presented the initial site plan. And at that time, took additional feedback from the group. A couple weeks later, I had a subsequent meeting with VNA board members where they had, who had been at that initial site plan meeting, and they asked us to refine the site plan, increase the size of the lots, and provide fewer homes. And we did have, we lost 10 to 12% of the homes and increased the lot sizes. Then about a month and a half later, met again with the board members, showed them the revised site plan based on their last inputs, and that revised site plan is the site plan that's here before you tonight. So it's sort of gone through the very involved public outreach meeting process, and to this day I still have continued open communication with the board members. There's a lot of people in the organization itself, so all of my communication is through the members themselves. So the project objectives, there's a lot of text on here. I'm just going to highlight. This is really, these objectives are in the specific plan. They really drive the site plan. It's for a mixed-use community that has a neighborhood commercial center. A variety of resident lifestyles can be accommodated with the differing home sizes and the lot sizes. It will increase Verdemont's recreational opportunities by the increase of Ronald Reagan Park. It is compatible with surrounding neighborhoods, and I'll show you that. And it is, we have created a pedestrian environment, and I have a couple of graphics that show that. It'll improve the circulation by improving West Little League Drive and Magnolia, which is currently a dirt road next to the site, and provide additional public parking. The soccer complex, they currently, a lot of parking currently exists on our site, as it's always been done, but just because it's always been done doesn't mean they're on public property. But Magnolia Avenue being improved will actually create a curb and gutter street that will accommodate a lot of parallel parking, curbside parking that will help the soccer complex. We designed this project after hearing some inputs about, you know, people in Verdemont or really enjoy their toys. Right, so they're up there on the way up to the desert or to the mountains, and so RVs and other toys, we heard that, and so we removed several of the lots so that we could create an on-site RV storage yard to minimize the amount of toys that a lot of our neighborhoods. We all live in neighborhoods that people just park their RVs and toys on the curb, so that's going to minimize that. Really creates an amenity for the community. We'd reduce water consumption and energy consumption. And as I'll note later, we provide a fiscally sound project through the increase of property tax and sales tax. This is the community site plan. Chantal provided an overview. The commercial area, which is on the right side of this graphic, is envisioned as a grocer with a drugstore type component, inline retail, and a standalone restaurant pad. The amount of activity, and I'm sharing something that the neighbors have told me, the amount of activity from kids and parents from the the world famous Little League events that occur, as well as a soccer complex every night, and yet these kids and parents have nowhere to go during the event. I mean, not nowhere to go, but nowhere nearby. So restaurant pad makes so much sense. The lot sizes, the orange, the darker yellow color, those are 5,000 square foot lots, minimum 5,000 square foot lots, and the more tan color, those are minimum 7,000 square foot lots. So the total project's 120. It's broken out about 50-50, 50%, 50% in those two lot sizes. It is a gated community. We felt that very important in this location for it to be a gated community. And then Ronald Reagan Park extension is across the street. I mentioned about the community setting. One of the things that we included in our design, I don't know if this, does this have a pointer?
Yeah,
the button with the red line. Okay, perfect. initially, when we designed the project, so Cable Creek, as we've been talking about, that channel runs through here. We had, you know, put homes up along all of Cable Creek because, you know, internally these homes would have a lot of, you know, the new homes would have, you know, basically open space behind them or not have, you know, structures behind them. The residents that came to the meeting, a lot of them living here along this street, asked if there was a way that we could maximize the distance, the separation between the front of their homes and then our new project. And so we designed the project in a way that there are no residential homes along this edge, and then there's a street, and then the row of homes that does face the homes in Verdemont that are closest to it are front on, which means these folks are going to look across and they're going to see front architecture, right, instead of seeing the back wall. And that was, that we were very cognizant of the request when we did that. One of the recreational amenities inside the project as part of the private recreation is a linear. This is, again, where we had pulled the lots back. So this is that open space area with the channel up here and those homes I was just talking about that front on to this park. So it includes a turf area for, you know, ball play, you know, throwing frisbee, dogs, not throwing the dogs, but walking the dogs. And then, you know, some children's play areas and trails. Also is a pocket park at one of the entries, to the community. And then this is oriented just a little askew, but this paseo area, that's the paseo here, and then we have a required on-site detention basin. It's actually not that low. It's only a couple, 3 feet, but on-site detention basin with a paseo next to it in the southeast corner of the site will allow for the residents to walk, you know, walk down to this location of the property and then walk into the commercial area without getting in the car. Otherwise, you know, otherwise you'd have to walk all the way around the block. And so we created an opening in the wall and the fence there so that it would be a gated pedestrian access into the commercial center to increase walkability. On the other side of the channel, there is Ronald Reagan Park, and I've visited there a couple times now, and it is such a treasure that the city and Verdemont community has this piece of the Berlin Wall. It's just amazing, amazing. And we have a half-acre piece of property that is adjacent to the existing Ronald Reagan Park, and today it's weeds and a tree. That's what's there today because it hasn't been improved, so it's just weeds and one tree. As part of this Ronald Reagan Park expansion, we'll improve those half-acre property, put in a gazebo and an interpretive kiosk and just some seating areas. One thing I wanted to mention that during the two-year process, I was fortunate to get to know a lot of the Verdemont neighbors and as well as the neighborhood board members. One of the board members who was very approachable during this whole process was one of the co-presidents, and the presidents are Barbara Skye and Michael Kraft. And Michael was just such a gentleman, and I'm sure many in this audience or in this chamber already know, but Michael Kraft passed away in October, just this past October. He was actually in these chambers at our scoping meeting, and he's just always such a gentleman. And as a result of just, you know, our limited experience and the impact that he made on Verdemont and also in the city of San Bernardino, because I know he was also on other committees in the city, the project will include this gazebo, as I mentioned, and that'll be the Michael Kraft Memorial Gazebo. The specific plan does create the guidelines and standards for architecture styles so that it is in the California theme or definitely more specifically in the theme that are related to Verdemont and San Bernardino with the more of the agricultural heritage. So having the ranch, craftsmen, and some Spanish styles, limiting the architectural styles to that for both the commercial as well as the residential. These are just some examples of how those styles and the elements that those styles have. There's a lot of economic benefits to this property, which is currently just 40 acres, just sitting there. And we had a fiscal impact and economic impact analysis prepared. And based on those studies, this project, when constructed, will increase the city's economic base through increased property tax, but also on-site sales tax. So those revenues, those net revenues, are around $330,000 annually to the city's general fund. Providing local employment through that commercial center will provide, you know, local opportunities for residents and therefore improve the jobs housing balance and reduce, hopefully reduce, vehicle miles traveled as we all deal with traffic in our cities. It will improve the existing and future public roadways, as I sort of touched on. It will benefit existing local businesses as homes and commercials. Businesses need, you know, ongoing service or maintenance contracts or different products. Through the construction phase, approximately 560 full and part-time jobs will be created. And I think maybe more importantly, as the ongoing operations of the project, approximately 360 full and part-time employment positions as a result of the commercial center. We're very proud of all the time and effort we've put into this project to get to this point. We appreciate the VNA and all of their inputs. We appreciate the city staff who have been very helpful along this path. Some of our technical team is here tonight. If there are some specific questions, we do ask your commission for an approval tonight. And thank you for your time, your leadership, and we're here to answer any questions. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Flodine, for the efforts your group has put in contacting the local community. Any efforts? I attended a couple of those meetings just as an observer. I'm not a member of VNA. And I appreciate the fact that you went and you got public input before you got too involved in the project, and you modified your project to meet some of the standards and requests of the local citizens. I appreciate that as a citizen of San Bernardino.
Yes, sir.
Any questions for Mr. Flodine?
Commissioner Agnew. Just one comment. I am a board member of the NAC, and I knew Michael Kraft, and he was a very, very unique man. He was a really good guy, and we really miss him. And I want to say thank you to you and to the Verdemont Neighborhood Association for doing that memorial gazebo for him. I think that's a really nice touch to the whole project. So thank you.
You're welcome. It's amazing in 2 years how he connected with me so strongly. So I can only imagine for those who knew him so much longer.
Any other questions? Commissioner Earp?
Hi. Yeah, I have a couple questions. First off, kind of going back to the levy.
Yes.
Project. So you talked about there was room for rebuilding the levy or building it up. You know, where you got the park in there, but where the houses are, you know, up against it in the center area, is there still enough? How does that work?
Yeah. So the grading, grading design for our site will allow for a certain amount of fill to get the finished pads, the finished pad level of the homes to be above that flood zone. If it were to be decertified, our pads would be above that new flood zone level. And in addition, I think what Mr. Teague was referring to is we have the space and the access back there to put in a flood wall, which isn't a dam. It's like a pony wall. It's really just it's a wall with a lower footing, with a deeper footing, and it could be just 2 to 3 feet above that. So we have the ability to work with that. And I think Mr. Allard mentioned that, you know, flood and the county, I'm hoping the city is working with FEMA on this, because if FEMA were to decide that they were decertifying this levy, which based on everybody I've talked to at the county, water's never gone over this. The improved portion of this levee is from Little League, you know, all the way south. It's never gone above that. But if they were to decertify it, I counted about 100 to 200 homes that are north of the creek that are going, that their flood insurance is going to go way up. So it's really a regional problem. But for our own project, we have, you know, in our grading plan, our grading design, we will be having the finish pads above that, so there will not be a safety concern.
Okay. But the flood wall you spoke about, that would that be something that would be on
at the property line
project, or would that be a public
at the PL at the property line?
Okay.
Yeah. So by the time we got to that point, we would know because more time would have occurred. Right. Yes.
And then another question: the grocery store, is that a full size?
It's designed as a full size.
Okay.
So the 98,000 square feet is from the market analysis, because we don't want to put one that was too a center that was too big or too small, because, you know, other visions for this property way before we owned it, you know, back in the day, it was going to be a big box, you know, big box center. Then it was going to be a warehouse. We really wanted to know what the neighborhood needed. So based on all of that input, it's designed as a traditional market, which is in the 40-ish thousand square foot. That's how that's designed. If it goes to more of a specialty, like a Barron's or an Aldi, or I know everybody likes to say Trader Joe's, but you know, those are usually in the 20,000 to 30,000. So there's a lot of flexibility in that once the specific tenant is selected.
Okay. And I guess one more general question is the specifics of, like, right now we're just talking about the plan, right? I mean, the specific plan. Specifics like if, you know, traffic lights were going to be required, that would happen later, that would still be reviewed, or is that part of this?
If the commission recommends, so this would have to go to the city council. I should clarify that. The planning commission is making a recommendation to the council. All of the off-site improvements are embodied in this plan, and the maximum number of lots and maximum square footage for the commercial. So that's already been embodied in this. The only follow-on piece, if you will, would be the final design of the homes that are actually built. But the design guidelines that are Chapter 4 of the specific plan talk about roof pitches, architectural styles, building materials. So to answer your question, Commissioner Earp, that's all been addressed. The off-site improvements are in here. And then I'd also like to follow up on the question that you had and Commissioner Gallagher had about Cable Creek. It is an issue that the Public Works Department has been working with County Flood and FEMA. My department's also been working with them for well over 5 years. Because as Mr. Flodine has pointed out, this is really a more of a neighborhood-wide or regional issue, because if Cable Creek is decertified, as he's indicated, there's over 100 homes that would be in the floodplain, and that would make their insurance prohibitively expensive. So it is an issue that we've been working on. There is disagreement between county flood control and the Army Corps of Engineers. So it is something that has been addressed, but unfortunately we just haven't been able to come to resolution. The Army Corps goes at its pace, and their pace is different, I think, than everybody else's.
What elevation is your final pad that you were going to build? You said will be above the levee of the creek.
You're asking
inches,
for a specific
feet?
Element? I mean, a specific elevation foot?
Right.
Or you're asking how far above?
Right. I'll
ask our engineer. You're saying how far above the flood?
The level of the levee of the
Cable
Creek.
I'll have our engineer look that up.
That you're constructing.
I'll have our engineer look that up. I don't know off the top of my head. Commissioner?
Approximately 5 feet.
5 feet above?
Above the high water mark.
5 feet. 5 feet above the high water mark. If you recall, you know, if you think of when most of us, when you go home, your driveway may be maybe up or down, but most of them you drive up your home. That's, you know, that's already picking up 2 to 3 feet. So we'll just have to raise it a little further, and we'll clear that high water mark.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess, you know, the last question is, that in the opinion of the staff, that the grocery store and the stuff, we won't need any more traffic improvements, light to get in and out of the parking lot?
I would have to look at the actual or the final set of conditions. I didn't work on it to the level that Chantal did, but I know that traffic engineering has reviewed this. It did go through an EIR process. I don't remember, Chantal, do you know what the specific traffic improvements are?
They haven't had any requirements beyond what was.
Mr. Persico, if I may. As part of the EIR, traffic impact analysis was prepared. Our engineers here tonight, if you have specifics. The traffic impact analysis looked at, you know, traffic volumes and flows and that sort of thing that you would be used to seeing in a project like this. Based on the X number of driveways, you know, five driveways, it recommends improvements, the improvements that you're speaking of, as well as line of sight distances. So the traffic impact analysis, which is part of the EIR, does include that analysis.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, we are aware that traffic is an issue up there, and that was fully analyzed. And the Public Works, our in-house traffic engineer, did review. We go through what's called a peer review. So while they prepared the traffic study, it was done. We told them what intersections to study, what the scope of the traffic study should be. They prepared it, and then it was peer reviewed by our internal staff.
Director Persico, the impact fees that will be generated from this development, will it be retained for improvements in that area, or will it go into the general fund and go wherever in the city?
The traffic, there's actually two traffic impact fees. There are the regional fees, Measure I, which do go to Sandbag, which is now SBCTA, I think. County Transportation Authority. It's going to take a while to get that down. So those monies go to regional improvements. There are local traffic impact fees, and those local fees do stay locally. They do also pay park fees. This is, I believe, part of the Verdemont CFD. Is that
correct, Haseeb? Is it part of the Verdemont CFD? Yes, it is.
So there's a Verdemont fire CFD fee that's paid to County Fire. So to answer your question, Chair Heasley, most of the money does stay locally, except for the Measure I money, which goes to the County Transportation Authority, and then the Verdemont fees pay for maintenance and staffing at the Verdemont Fire Station.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Flodoy? I do have speaker slips. Thank you, sir. I have a Josh Bourgeois, if I'm spelling it or saying it correctly. Please say and spell your last name and your address for the tape record, sir.
Welcome. Good evening. My name is Josh Bourgeois. It's spelled B-O-U-R-G-E-O-I-S. And I am with the Golden State Environmental Justice Alliance, formerly SoCal Environmental Justice Alliance. I don't know why this term. Oh, timer's going. Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you this evening. As I said, my name is Josh Bourgeois, and I'm with the Golden State Environmental Justice Alliance. We believe that the environmental impact report is flawed and should be redrafted and recirculated. Due to the time limit, I obviously won't be able to get through all of the concerns that we laid out, but if necessary, you can refer back to the original comments letter that we turned in. Just briefly tonight, I'll touch on a couple of issues, the first being in regards to traffic. The draft environmental impact report states that the applicant will be required to construct or pay its fair share to create a second southbound lane at the intersection of University Parkway and Kendall Drive. However, if the applicant chooses to pay a fee, there is no timeline given for construction of the additional turn lane or a deadline by which it must be built. There is no statement of which program or funding source the payment will go towards or if this program is already established. An assessment of fees is appropriate when linked to a specific mitigation program. Payment of fees is not sufficient when there is no evidence mitigation will actually result. Mitigation measure TRA-1 is uncertain and improperly deferred in violation of CEQA. Secondly, in regards to noise impacts, the project summary states, quote, the proposed phasing does not preclude the project applicant's ability to construct all of the necessary project infrastructure in phase one, nor does it preclude the applicant's ability to construct both phases one and two simultaneously. However, phased construction is not required of the project. The draft EIR does not present any analysis of impacts or potential mitigation measures from overlap of construction phases. There is no statement the construction phases will not occur concurrently. There is a statement that the applicant will have the ability to construct both phases one and two simultaneously. The noise study is deficient and does not account for the worst case scenario or all possible scenarios in which the impacts are more significant than the best case scenario presented. Further, these significant impacts to sensitive receptors near the project site must be represented accurately. The draft EIR must be revised to fully disclose an accurate estimation of noise impacts from the proposed project. And with that, I'm almost out of time. Again, I thank you for the opportunity, and you can refer back to our original comments letter if necessary. Thank you.
I am not putting a time limit on you. I'd like to hear everything that you need to tell us.
Okay. Because of the how everything's gone, I only prepared 3 minutes. So, and I've never been given any more time anywhere else unless it's for like an appeal hearing where I'm given a specific 10 or 15 minutes. So I haven't prepared more than 3 minutes, which is what I'm allotted. So I appreciate it, but unfortunately at this point I don't have other preparations to be able to go ahead and talk for longer than the allotted amount of time, which is normally given, which is 3 minutes. I do, again, appreciate it, but like I said, I prepared 3 minutes. So
have you sent all your comments to the city staff as well?
Right. All of our comments were put in a letter, which was responded or sent in response to the draft environmental impact report. So that's why I reference that you can refer back to that for the full scope of our comments, which, again, I can't get through in the 3 minutes and nor am I prepared to tonight just because of, again, the standard operating procedure is, you know, you get 3 minutes to talk. So that's what I prepared for.
If I may, Chair, it's unfortunate that the speaker doesn't have more comments, but he is correct. They did submit a letter as part of the draft EIR on August 5th. Of 2016 in response to the draft being circulated. Each of those points, and there were 21 of them that they raised in their letter of August 5th, have been addressed in the final EIR. And we did go through in great detail. So we did consider all of their comments. We do believe that they have been addressed. There are a couple of issues, as Chantal pointed out in her presentation, some mitigation measures. But yeah, we do believe that all of the comments or concerns, I guess I should say, that were raised on August 5th have been addressed. I don't believe that there's any additional comments or questions you've raised beyond this August 5th letter.
No, as far as I'm aware, we've just submitted the comments letter, and then, you know, we did receive just the response portion
right,
of
the
it.
Required response.
Right.
So, yeah, we do believe that we've addressed their comments.
What did your group respond to the response that you received, or was there any more communication?
Well, because of the, I don't remember the exact date off the top of my head of when we received the comments letter. But I don't know if you guys have that available or not, but we just didn't have enough time to get our experts in to review it and send us feedback by the time I had to come here tonight. So that's just where we're at right now.
Are you asking for more time?
No, I'm not asking for more time. Under the circumstances, you know, again, we get 3 minutes to talk. That's kind of how the public comments under my understanding how it works. So, you know, I'm not asking for more time here tonight. I wouldn't want to be given any kind of special treatment or anything that any other member of the public wouldn't get. So in regards to that, like I said, my presentation for tonight's over, and I'm not asking for any more time or anything like that for anything, just to be clear.
Well, I was asking if when they responded to your concerns, was your group, because you were representing a group of residents, is it, or...
I'm representing the Golden State Environmental Justice Alliance. That's who I'm here representing.
Well, so what I'm asking is, when they responded, was that to your group's satisfaction?
They answered no, we still believe that the issues were not fully addressed in our estimation. Again, we haven't responded in an official letter back as of this point, but that's I'm just here tonight just to touch on a couple of those issues. So.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Graham.
I wanted to thank Mr. Bourgeois for his brevity in keeping his comments to 3 minutes, but I did want to make it clear that the City of San Bernardino, during public hearing, comments from the public does not limit speakers to only 3 minutes. We want people to state all of their objections, if any, on the record so it can be considered by the city staff. It does sound like he's basically referencing his comment letter, which is available in the backup, and the 21 points that were referenced by the community development director.
Thank you. We have Hank Mitchell. Name and address, and spell your last.
Hank Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L, Coyote Rock Ranch, Vermont. I've got a prepared read-off here, but I think I can answer some questions on Cable Creek for you, too, if you'll allow me later.
You need to adjust the mic, Mr. Mitchell.
Yes. Adjust the mic?
Thank you.
How's that?
Much better.
Am I there?
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to read because it's easier, because my mind wanders. This project was brought to our neighborhood association early in its infancy, and Eric Flodine is a... He's really cool. He came and he, like he said, he put up the chart. Everybody gave him all the suggestions in the world, and they worked diligently with the representatives of our area, most graciously, modifying at their expense to meet the suggestions made by us through Mike Kraft and others. It is, in my belief, to be a welcome site for our community, this project. The project has little impact on our current infrastructure above Irvington Avenue and the foothills in either direction. However, it will add a goodly amount of impact to the traffic below Irvington. That being said, this project, being gated and owner-occupied as we understood it, is good for our area. Though the lots are small, it still adds to the area growth in a positive way. I want to compliment the developer here for taking time to meet with my neighbors and listen and ask questions of our neighbors and show real intent to be a future neighbor. I am a new board member for the VNA, but I was at those meetings and they listened really well. The project, however great and good it is, will never look good to the residents, not because of the project or the developer, but because of City Hall. I'm asking you, the Planning Commission, to turn around and task the city itself to come forward and improve the traffic at the failed intersection of Palm and Kendall and the I-215 before this or any project is completed. Not to stop the project, but to get that intersection from failed to at least moving properly. Before the new warehouse opens, this is also going to go in operation. More failures at that intersection will only make this good developer look like the bad guy. The signals are set for once a day demand and then run all day at that demand, where in the afternoon it is just a hindrance on the timing. Traffic from the warehouse soon to open will task and cause greater failure, and who will look bad? The developer, not the city. The residents of Vermont are really ardent in their concern for these failed intersection issues, and the city has always turned their back on the subject for the spin on words. Planning Commission, you have to weigh in on this and make things go forward for the future smoothly. As for the safety of all who pass through the intersections, the developers cannot always be taking the blame. Every time a developer has come to Vermont, everybody has gone after the developer about traffic this and traffic that. Well, if the intersection was designed to handle the traffic we have now. I'm sure it could handle some more. I would offer to the Planning Commission to meet with the residents of Verdamont, the Verdamont Neighborhood Association, if you'd like they did, and discuss the issues at hand. I want to thank you, and I want to welcome Strada Palma's efforts to the neighborhood and their real involvement and the commitment to Mike Kraft's memory. He was quite a guy. We all enjoyed working with him, and I know that you spent a lot of time with him, and he came back and spent a lot of time with us, and he smoothed out a whole lot of discussion that we had at the neighborhood meetings, and he was actually a representative for you at times. So thank you very much. This project is a real positive. So I'd like to add about the – am I out of time? I'm sorry. Am I done?
No. Go ahead.
For the Cable Creek, after the 03 fire, our hills were like wax. Right after the fire in December, October 26th, we burnt through. They lost their home completely. But the hills were like wax. In December, from December through, I think it was around April, we received 48 inches of rain. It was just the weirdest thing, right after this huge fire. Cable Creek was pushed to its limits, absolute push to its limits. Myers Creek, Cable Creek, the hiking trail. What's the name? Anyway, all the creeks drained into that Cable Creek. It handled it. That would have been considered a 100-year flood to us. Myers Creek runs in front of my ranch. It topped over the road. We got a new culvert because of that. But Cable Creek handled it. So as far as your concerns, I doubt very much until we get greater development up there in Verdamont where Magnolia, Chestnut Trail Creek drainage, and then Palm. Those, when we get the rooftops and everything, it'll be like the hills having wax. We'll get the flow into the channel. But I think by then, I still wouldn't worry about it. It may get decertified because somebody has a degree on their forehead, but man, when it took everything that God could throw at it in 04, I don't think it'll fail. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. I may butcher the name, Hasib Kweishai.
I'm just here to answer questions.
Oh, all righty. And I have one last one, is a Mark Teague.
Awesome.
Okay. Both with the applicant, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? Myself as a Fifth Ward resident, think that this development, as it's been adjusted to meet the citizens in the Verdamont area, I don't live in Verdamont, but I've observed this. This is a boon to our community up in the Verdamont area. I think it's a very positive statement, and I'd like it to do more, but dollars are not there to do everything I want them to do, build a new interchange. That's the only way we're going to mitigate the traffic problems that we have at Palm and Kendall and 215 Freeway, is you're going to have growth, and it's very difficult to build your way out of congestion. Situation is, unless there's pressure brought by the local politicians to push Sandbagger's new moniker to improve traffic flow in the north end of San Bernardino, we're going to have to live with an increased congestion no matter what. Every house that's built, every building, the commercial establishment's built, is going to generate trips, and right now we're at failure rate on most of the intersections already. So can we improve it? With time, anything can be improved, but there's got to be a dedication by not just the public officials, but by the citizens themselves to demand the improvement and put the pressure where the pressure needs to be, which is the elected public officials. That's mine. I'll entertain a motion. Hopefully you guys will approve it.
I'll make a motion.
Commissioner Eggman.
I'll make a motion to approve
Resolution number 2017-014. The mayor and common council and approval of general plan amendment 16-01, development code amendment 16-01, specific plan 16-01, subdivision 16-02, tentative parcel map amendment, and subdivision 16-03, tentative tract map 2006, based on the findings of the fact.
I'll second that.
I have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? None. Carried unanimously. Thank you, Mr. Flodin. Thank you, Mr. Mitchell, for your comments. That's the end of the public hearing items. You're welcome to, as citizens, to stay. We have a discussion about alcohol beverage sales, which is a non-public hearing item. It's just information for us as commissioners.
Actually, we are having a slight technical difficulty, so maybe if it's okay with the commission, I can do my director's report.
Certainly.
Travis had to run upstairs to get some stuff. We will do a slight non sequitur. I would like to update the Planning Commission on recent action that the City Council took relative to Theater Square. I don't know if anybody watched the City Council meeting last Wednesday. I guess it was a week ago tonight. The City Council did approve the first phase of the Carousel Mall project, which is Theater Square, which will allow up to 25,000 square feet of new retail and restaurant space in front of the Regal property. Regal, I think, as you've heard me say at least a couple of times, this 14-screen theater is one of the top-performing theater properties in the entire Regal chain. It brings in almost 800,000 patrons a year, and that is without any restaurant or adjacent retail. For those of us who like to go to the movies with family and friends, you like to get something to eat before or after, like to make a little bit of an evening or an afternoon out of it. You don't have the opportunity currently. And it's still bringing in over 750,000 people a year. And that has been increasing. The patronage, because the city does own the property, Regal is a tenant of the city, so we get their monthly sales figures, and they are consistently each month growing in the number of customers that they get. So very exciting first phase of the project. With that approval, we are going to be in the process with the end of redevelopment. One of the requirements under the bill that ended redevelopment is cities need to sell off all of their properties. So we will now begin the process. We've been in discussions with a couple of potential developers to buy the property. Once we have a purchase and sale agreement, that will go to the City Council for their final approval. Once that happens, property will be sold, and the proceeds off of that, which are estimated to be $10 million, will be used to fund demolition of the Carousel Mall. We don't have exact figures for demolition. We're in the process of finalizing those right now. Because the building was built in 1973, when asbestos was widely used because it was viewed as a very good insulator. Fast forward 40 years later, we find out that it's not the wonder chemical that everybody thought that it was. So there's that's the number that we're really trying to determine, and we're in the process of doing an asbestos survey of the building so that we can finalize that number. But very exciting, the council did approve that. So when a purchaser is found, they'll work with the staff, go through the DERC process for the actual construction of those commercial buildings. Phase two, which is the mall itself, We are working with the development team of AECOM and Franzen to put together a strategic plan for that property. We'll actually, given the size of the property, the mall is a 43-acre site, we're actually discussing doing a mini-specific plan. If that is done, that would come to the Planning Commission, and just as you did on the Rancho Palma project, the Commission would be reviewing that specific plan and recommending approval of that to the Council. So that's what I wanted to give you an update on. I do believe that all of you received copies of the major project list electronically. If you'd like physical copies, we can get those for you. And I'd be, would like to make a plug for Third Thursday tomorrow. We have 6 food trucks coming, so if any of you are available, you're always welcome. And I'm happy to answer any questions before we go back to Travis's presentation.
I got one for you.
Yes.
Mr. Persico. We approved and they built that new Loma Linda project on G Street.
Correct.
The sidewalk and gutters have been fenced with temporary fence for a long time. Can you tell me if you know anything about what's delaying the completion of that project? It sure looks bad.
It does. Nobody is happy with that, particularly Loma Linda, as the proud new owner of a $65 million building that has flooding. The building is occupied under what's called a temporary certificate of occupancy because they weren't able to finish all their off-site improvements. Loma Linda was awarded a $2 million federal EDA grant, but one of the conditions of receiving the $2 million, and that money would be for all off-site improvements, one of the conditions of receiving that money was showing proof that the city owns the street. It's been a public street, as far as we can tell, back to the late 1800s, but we haven't been able to prove to the satisfaction of federal EDA that we, the city, own that street as a public street. So it's frustrating for everybody, particularly Loma Linda, and they are considering other options to finance those improvements and just go ahead and make them. I know Stephen Graham in the city attorney's office has spent a considerable amount of time with federal EDA and the title company, and nobody's been able to satisfy EDA, so the money hasn't come yet. I know that Loma Linda is exploring options. They may just wind up financing the off-site improvements on their own.
Who do they think owns it?
Well, that's a good. I don't know if Steven's got more information on that, but
maybe I can jump in here just really briefly. This is a clash of bureaucracies. The federal government does not understand how title to property is established in the state of California. Their forms are based on other states. They want an attorney's opinion. Which is not how it is done in the state of California. We go through title companies, get title insurance, do all that. And what Mark said is essentially where we're at, which is the title company, they don't work on the basis of common sense, like we all would, which is who else do you think owns it? They need a document that shows the chain of ownership there. And because this road is so old, those documents don't exist. So we're working on alternatives, but that's the answer to your question, bureaucracy. And I'm sorry.
Yeah, we've been able to trace it back about 140 years. You know, it was one of the original streets laid out by the Mormon settlers, and it's been used as a road for 160 years. But we haven't gotten to that original document. So, as Stephen so eloquently said, it's a clash of bureaucracies.
Let me ask you a question. Does the city have an official map that shows that street?
The city has many maps that show that street. but But a document that establishes that this is city-owned right-of-way, no. Not that I'm aware of. That document may exist, but and Mark could probably go into an excruciating detail. The amount of records, and especially old records, that this city has, and the state that those records are in, and city staff ability to locate and identify them, was already pretty bad before the bankruptcy, and it hasn't gotten particularly better. So, I mean, essentially what they're asking for is prove that you own it. I would go out there and show them the street that has been built upon it for hundreds of years. That is insufficient for their purposes.
Let me ask you, can you prove that you own East Street?
Most of the other streets in the city have much more recent documentation on them. This isn't abnormality because it is one of the original streets of the city. And even if there was a map, it probably wouldn't have any references on it that would be particularly useful to a modern surveyor.
Isn't there a building on the east side of that, just south of the ball field, that's kind of a historic home that's turned into something else?
Perhaps. I'm not envisioning what you're thinking of. I know that there's the entrance to the ball stadium. You go south,
it's a commercial. It's south of the ball stadium.
I'm not familiar.
I think there's a building that you wouldn't know that it was old, but I think it is very old. I wonder if that was sometime long ago, an entrance to that.
Yeah, I think we're all using common sense. Unfortunately, common sense is not carrying the day. So we have literally, certainly more the city attorney's office than anybody else has spent hours and hours on this with no positive outcome. So there's the answer. Yeah, and it's frustrating because it's a gorgeous building and we should all be very proud of it, but it's standing behind a lake. Yeah.
Are we going to continue to meet in this building?
We are in the process. The City Council recently approved a lease for Vanner Tower, as well as 215 D Street, which is the building on the northeast corner of D and 2nd Street, three-story office building where LAFCO has some offices. And then the third lease, which I think is close but not yet finalized, for the Sebeda building. So City Hall will be, departments will be in three separate locations. We are working on those plans currently. The final date to move out of here, the city manager is very focused on getting people out as soon as possible. We're anticipating it sometime in the April-May timeframe. But we're a large organization, and making it all happen is turning out to be a lot of work. The plan is that we be in the three locations for 2 to 3 years while improvements are done on the old EDA building, also referred to as the 201 building. So this building has two design defects. When it was built in 1973, it met all standards of the time. But what happens every time there's a major earthquake, all of the structural engineers and seismologists get together to determine what buildings failed and what caused those failures. And that's why every 3 years the building code is updated. The City Council adopted an ordinance in December implementing the newest code cycle. So this building, built in 1973, met all the codes at the time. When the Northridge earthquake happened, steel moment frame buildings, which are commonly used for high-rise or medium and high-rise buildings, failed for the first time ever. Structural engineers had never seen that. This building is a steel moment frame building. The other thing that happened in the Northridge earthquake, if you may remember, the apartment collapse, the apartment building in Northridge collapsed and I believe killed 15 or 20 occupants. That had soft story construction. This building has both soft story construction and steel moment frame. So we have two design defects that didn't become apparent until the Northridge earthquake. So we are in the process of moving out of the building. The 201 building will be retrofitted. It's a steel moment frame building, so it only has one. And it's much easier to fix that than it is to fix this soft story, because that's the whole portion that cantilevers out the breezeway that you walk in when you come into the front of City Hall. That's what's referred to as soft story construction, so you don't have structural elements around the entire perimeter wall going down to the ground. So the 201 building will be upgraded in the next 2 to 3 years to meet critical facility standards, the same standards that the police department meets, so that in a major event, City Hall would still be available to be used. So that's why we can't move into the 201 building immediately. So we're going to these three locations. It's going to be quite an inconvenience for the public, most importantly, because we won't all be in a single building and we'll have to send people to potentially one or two different locations. So we hope to be out of here within the next probably 30 to 90 days. And then we'll all be able to regroup the 201 building in probably 36 months. That's the three-story building at the edge of the parking structure. That's where the Economic Development Agency was located. The single-story portion out on the corner, I was told, was a Thrifty's drugstore. Yeah. So we'll be occupying that whole building, ultimately. So if that answers your question.
Certainly.
Long explanation, I know.
Are we ready, Mr. Martin?
We're now ready, thank you. All right, tonight, our last item. We just wanted to go through, you know, we a lot of concerns about alcohol-related businesses in the city. There's a lot of conflicting standards with our department, alcoholic beverage control, and how we process them. And we've had some questions on existing outlets that we do have in the city. So we kind of just wanted to take some time and go back over, at least at some level, all of those topics. First thing, just to kind of refresh some of the terminology that we use with ABC licensing. We have three basic categories of license types. Those are off-sale retail. That's, you know, where you purchase the alcohol at a, you know, market or some type of store, take it for consumption at another property. You have the on-sale retail, which are your restaurants, bars, things like that. And then your non-retail licenses, which are more your manufacturers and distributors, which we do have a couple here in the city. And then with the way that we process, and I know this comes up every time we discuss one, we have to review them not based off of citywide or council wards or things that we may necessarily be more immediately familiar with. It's based off of the census tracts that are established, you know, every 10 years. Through ABC, they utilize the census tracts that are established by the government to figure out kind of density and how many licenses should be allowed. A little bit of information just on the tracts. They're generally established trying to be between 1,200 and 8,000 people. Around 4,000, you know, hopefully is kind of an average. Because of that, they don't have fixed geographical boundaries. They're not all 2 square miles or a square mile or something like that. They fluctuate because you have commercial areas that don't have residential. Those are going to be larger. You have the north end of town where it's all neighborhoods. Those tracts are much smaller because you have more dense groupings of residents. And then, like I said, every 10 years when we do the census, they can be split, they can be merged, you know, modified as population changes, people move, new residential is constructed. And like I mentioned, based off those tracts and based off the population of them, because even though they do try to keep them similar sizes in terms of population, they're not, no system is perfect. So some end up having more than others. And ABC, based off of that population, establishes how many licenses should be approved for each tract. Obviously, the more people you have, the more licenses are appropriate. As we all know, we have many tracts in the city that are over-concentrated. What that means is that there are more licenses active, approved in that tract, than what ABC originally authorizes. What that doesn't mean, though, is that we can't continue to process something in that tract. It simply adds an extra step to the process, and we now have to make the finding of public convenience or necessity, explaining why this business, why this license would need that approval, and that's the item you typically see at the commission here, along with the conditional use permit or other permit. And then once we approve the licenses, typically, you know, we approve a license, they get it through the department, they open up their business, they're operating, that's deemed an active license. At that point, there's really no additional city involvement. Just like when we license a business through the city with a business license, they can renew it every year as long as they stay in line with their conditions, they have no operational issues, they can just keep renewing it and continue their business as it is. The next down the line would be suspended licenses. That's where, you know, for some reason, through the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, they've temporarily halted the license. There are still criteria, because it's only suspended, where the department can reactivate that license, you know, if they satisfy whatever the concern of ABC may be. And that's without going back through the city. There's a time frame to that. It's typically a 90-day window. But they, you know, they can stop them, they can restart them, and we don't have to go and review it again. The next two are when they cease the activity on the site, and you can either have your license revoked or canceled. If it's revoked, it's been shut down by the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control because of some compliance issue. If it's canceled, that's if a business is closing and they voluntarily close their license. And then there's a couple sections. Well, I'll step back. One of the, as many of us know, one of the conditions that we've been trying to place on businesses lately, the off-sale businesses, is to acquire the two licenses, have the one for the premises, for the operation of the business, and then acquire a separate, you know, in the attempt to reduce the total number in the city. We've been putting that on projects, and we've been doing our best to implement that. In recent conversations with representatives from the department, they've alerted us to some sections of the business professions code that governs what they do that creates some conflict there. The key issue in section 24040 is that when ABC issues a license, they have to issue it to a specific property. They will not sell or give somebody a license just for a speculative purpose. You can't just buy it because you want to, you know, hang it on the wall at home. You have to purchase it to put it on a property for the specific use at that property. Where this becomes an issue is, even though you have to assign it to a property, you can also only assign the one of that type to a property. So when we're now requiring that they have an additional license, they have nowhere that they can assign it because they already, the secondary license, the primary they put on the property of the business, when they get the second license, they can't assign it to that property, but they can't just purchase it and immediately deactivate it. They have to first put it on a property, and they now have nothing to assign it to because we've given no authorization to put it on any additional property, and we run into some hiccups there. The other thing, an additional note with it, is that when you do buy a license and when you assign it, you're meant to utilize it within 30 days to start the business, unless you have a business that you're in construction with. this is the separate standard that speaks to deferring the activation of the license for construction. And then some information about the city. And I know we've had some comments before on this, wanting to kind of get a little more broader perspective of what do we have in the city. When we bring forward one license, but we're only looking at one property, we're not looking citywide at that point. Staff has gone through in the last month or so, looked at all the active licenses that the department has. This is as of the first of this month, so about as up-to-date as we could get it for this meeting. Within the city limits, we have a total of 217 licenses, or 317 licenses, I apologize, I misspoke. That breaks down to 166 off-sale, 144 on-sale, and then 7 of the non-retail. Additionally, even though it's not within the city limits, I know we look at it kind of as, within the scope of the city, our sphere of influence, all of the county pockets we have. We have 20 additional off-sale licenses and 3 additional on-sale. So that's a total between the city and the sphere of 340 licenses. As I mentioned with the census tracts, we do have 60 that are in the city. These are a little more complicated than just looking at city limits, because tracts aren't drawn based off where city limits are. So there are 60 in the city, but those are not wholly contained within the city. A good portion of them overlap with Rialto or Highland or County or otherwise. Of those, and I know there was an exhibit in the packet that elaborates on this a little more, we have, for off-sale retail, we have 24 of those tracts that are over-concentrated. Not all to the same degree. It's explained more clearly in the table, but whether they have one extra license or they have 5 extra licenses, they're still deemed over-concentrated. And for the on-sale retail, we have 13 that are over-concentrated. And then this was one question I think we had before, just kind of a breakdown by ward. As you can see, just going down, we have wards 1 through 7, just on the left-hand side, and then our off-sale retail, our on-sale, and our non-retail, and then just totals for each ward. This just kind of gives a general breakdown of what we have in the city. I did include attachments in the report that break it down a little more specifically as to what types, whether it's beer and wine licenses or general licenses, restaurants, bars, markets, what it may be. As you can see, there's a fair distribution across the city. It's not that one track necessarily has all of them. There are some kind of outliers. The third ward does have noticeably more than many other tracks. But we all know that the third ward does contain the hospitality corridor. So we have a lot more retail down there, a lot more of our restaurants down there. So it's anticipated that would have the higher number of licenses. That being said, with all these tables, it's hard to translate that. Where does that actually sit with the city? It's hard to visualize that because I don't have all the census tracts memorized. I know this exhibit is a little difficult to read, and I apologize for that. It's a very large city, and we're trying to put a lot of information on here. This outlines, you can see they're very small, but we have kind of little black emblems and these little brown emblems that just kind of show the general concentration. They don't speak to all the what the businesses specifically are, but what this shows just kind of is an example of what I was mentioning about the geographic boundaries. When you go into the north end, kind of all fronting the 210, very small census tracts because those are primarily all yellow. Those are all the residential. When you get down to the hospitality area, you can see the tract goes basically all the way up to Central. So from the 10 freeway all the way up to Central. And the one next to it includes kind of the restaurant row area along hospitality all the way up to where Valley College is. So that's why it's difficult looking at all of these kind of the same, because you may have more in a track, but you may still be 2 miles from the next business or more just because of the geographic boundaries. And then the secondary exhibit, just to show kind of the breakdown by ward, just because I think that's what we're a little more familiar with. And you can still see, as was shown also on the table, it's spread out quite a bit throughout the city. Obviously, we have, Mount Vernon has a lot more. You still have businesses on E Street, a lot along hospitality, you know, where our primary business corridors are. And then when you get into the higher end of town in Vertimont area specifically, you know, it's mostly residential. As we know from the specific plan project, we don't have a lot of commercial up there, so there's not a lot of licenses in that area. And then just the last section, just a little bit on our deemed approved ordinance. What this is, this was an ordinance that was adopted back by the council in September of 2010. What this was to do is to primarily establish two things. The first being the requirement for conditional use permits for all alcohol outlets. That's why we now bring them to the commission. And the second was knowing that we have a lot of outlets that are in the city that were existing prior to this, as long as they were legal outlets, they had city licenses, you know, they were legally operating like any other business, we granted them what we referred to as the deemed approved status, which just said that you are now permitted for the alcohol sales under this ordinance. With that, we still put standard conditions on that, or not conditions, but operating requirements that they still have to meet, very similar to the conditions that we put on our new entitlements, if not, you know, if not necessarily at the same level. What those are, in order for a business to retain its status, does have to comply with these following conditions. I did abbreviate these a little bit just for the sake of the slide. They're spelled out just in the exact text from the code in the staff report. The first is really just not endangering or causing adverse effects to public health, safety, and welfare of the surrounding properties and the residents. That's a standard, obviously, and that's why we have the concern of it, because we know that alcohol can lead to some adverse impacts. The second is not having repeated nuisance activities on the property. So if there were a lot of call-outs, something on the property that are always specifically tied to alcohol, they're not being mitigated, then potentially that could lose the status for a property, and they would no longer be permitted, at least by the city. Thirdly is just compliance with all the state, local, and federal laws. That's, you know, our requirements, both in the code here and, you know, the requirements for alcoholic beverage control. The next one is just the upkeep of the property. Obviously, just as we would require with any property, frankly, you know, they have to maintain it in an appropriate order, and they have to ensure that the operations of that business, whatever it may be, a restaurant or a market or otherwise, are still compatible with the surrounding area. They're not, you know, again, you know, kind of referring to the first item, not causing negative impacts in the property or the neighborhood. And then lastly, and this is also one that we do put on any new entitlement, is that they still have to have completed the responsible training for the sales and service of alcoholic beverages. The counter to that is what you do to lose the status. You know, as long as any business operates under those other requirements, they're fine. We have no issue with them, just like we wouldn't with any that we put a CUP on. But there are a series of things that a property can do that would void that kind of, you know, quote-unquote grandfathered status and now require the new entitlements. The first of that is if any business chooses to change their license type. So if they're selling beer and wine, they now want to be able to sell distilled spirits as well. That's an upgrade in license type. That would kind of reset the clock, and we'd have to now go and process the full entitlement for the alcohol activity. The second one is kind of the bulk of the items. It's if they do any substantial change to the mode or character of the operations of the business. That could be done in a number of different ways, whether they're proposing to increase the display area for the beverages. And this goes both for on-sale and off-sale, so both types. It doesn't speak to non-retail licenses, though, since they don't have the direct sales activity. But if they do increase the display area, if they increase the sales or service area, that would be more appropriate for your restaurants. If you try to extend the hours of operation beyond what they're currently operating with, or if the license has been suspended, or, and this was what I kind of alluded to earlier, if the license ceases activity, you know, by the department or otherwise for more than 90 days, then we say you've now lost your status and you have to come back in and reapply and process through the current requirement. That goes to whether the ABC department suspends the activity or revokes the activity, or whether they simply close their business. And we have had that come up on some where businesses have left, new businesses have tried to go in, and we said, no, it's been 6 months since there was a business in, and now you have to go through the new entitlement. Lastly, with this, one thing that this isn't really clear on, and it's one item that we did want to have a little bit of a discussion on, is, you know, we know, we said we have 327 in the city, or 317, sorry. We don't know right now, I'll be honest, for the department, exactly how many, how it breaks down with how many are operating as deemed approved or how many are operating under the correct entitlements. We are in the process of doing that, but with over 300, and I know kind of referring to the previous item with how our records are and staff availability, it's a process we're working through. What we do know is that we have a lot of businesses that are operating under the deemed approved. It's an older city. There's a lot of outlets that we know have been here, you know, for decades, or if not longer. And where we're running into some questions now are, you know, businesses, we've had a lot more interest in the last couple years with businesses wanting to come in and modernize their facilities. You know, new facade work, like redoing the store, reconfiguring things, maybe doing a lot of reconfigurations, especially with the properties, with parking, you know, for accessibility reasons or otherwise. You know, a lot of businesses are looking to reinvest, and where that comes, you know, kind of in where that comes to this is we have entitlement requirements for those businesses that they have to do to, you know, establish or to to remodel their facilities, and whether that would also trigger them coming for, review of an entitlement just to modernize the facility or to also review the alcohol sales. And it's kind of questionable because it speaks a little bit to if you're touching the alcohol activity, then it would trigger it. If not, it may not, but it's the code, it leaves a lot of room for interpretation, and we kind of wanted to get some thoughts on that and see how everybody would feel. So with that closes at least my part of the presentation. I know there's a lot of information, so I'm willing to answer any questions you may have and any thoughts on that issue.
And maybe before the questions get asked, Travis and Chantal have spent a lot of time pulling all this information together. We know that the commissioner's been asking for it, so we're glad that we're able to get it to you. So there are a lot of, as Travis said, a lot of information that we've given. And some of these are policy questions because the code in some cases is not very clear. One thing I think that might be helpful that I would like to suggest is that maybe there be a two-member ad hoc committee that could work with staff to maybe address some of these issues, some of the policy questions. We can explore what some of the issues are and what some of the options might be, and that we might be able to fold that into the development code update that then the entire commission would see. Mm-hmm. But doing it as a two-member ad hoc committee, I think, might be the most efficient way to go, certainly if that's what the chair and the commission would like to do. But as Travis said, we're happy to answer any questions we can and then see what the commission would like to do as next steps.
Commissioner Lopez.
Mark, I feel like you're heading us off at the pass. Yes, I volunteer for the ed. You do not have to drag me. I just have a couple of comments. I appreciate all the work we have been asking, and for the length of the time that I've been on this commission, I've not seen anything like this before. Mm-hmm. I was, as Stephen knows, back in probably 2003 when we started, used to do RBS trainings for all the retails here. And we continued to do it. It was a special project to educate retailers and see if we could reduce some of the problem. Mm-hmm. I was also one of the people behind promoting the deemed approved ordinance. I knew a lot about that. My only comments are, people live in these areas.
Mm-hmm.
And even though when we get an applicant who wants a permit to sell alcohol and we don't get a lot of people here, we're still beholden to make the best decision possible.
No,
so
of course.
You referenced the ABC has a formula in terms of determining oversaturated or not saturated.
Mm-hmm.
The next question has to be, why would ABC have a system to indicate to communities that a certain census tract is saturated with alcohol?
Because
mm-hmm. there's information, and they have that information as to, they'll tell you in other cities, you have a lot of them, especially off sale.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much concerned about establishments that sell food because the sale of alcohol is not their primary business. It is the sale of food, unless it's a bar. But we do have concerns. I have concerns, and I know the city has problems with some of our off sale. So we have 60 tracts, but counting the off sale and the on sale, the ones that are oversaturated, we have like 37.
Mm-hmm. I will say one thing, and I wasn't able to identify it on the table or on the slides, but you know it can be reviewed looking at the attachment that was given with the staff report. It's not 30, not to say how many that may it may eliminate, but some of the tracts may be over-concentrated in.
I understand.
So there is a minor
reduction.
And
then what
yeah.
you want to develop. In
yeah, the, I just wanted to add that for clarification.
You know, State Street in Redlands, but even mm-hmm. State Street in Redlands has problems. They've added more security because mm-hmm. of the problems of the establishment.
Yeah.
So, but I'm not so concerned about that. But the wards that you have, first, second, and mm-hmm. the third, with accepting the hospitality, those are some of our low-income areas that are oversaturated. People
mm-hmm.
do live there. And there is a lot of crossover, too. Like Mr. Quill had the discussion about the sign. I think he will say, hope you will say, that a lot of the off-sale retailers are the ones that are abusing the signage and all this other stuff.
Mm.
There's a lot of crossover.
I would say I wouldn't just tie that to alcohol. There's a lot of sign abuse just
yeah.
throughout the city.
So my question would be for ABC, and I don't mind asking it of the same analyst that addressed your answers. You know, what was the purpose? Why do they designate certain census tracts? Why is saturation a problem for ABC? And
mm-hmm.
that should be an indicator for us.
And I can tell you, I did speak to people as recently as this morning about that, because obviously dealing this is a situation where you get one question answered, it raises three more. So as we've been going through this, we're constantly chasing the next answer.
And
I would just say I've, with their department, with the representatives that I've spoken to, and it's been about two or three through the department, there are standards that are established in the Business Professions Code that where they rate, you know, the criteria of what ratio of how many licenses, and it goes based off, it's a little complicated. It's the population of the census tract. It considers the population in the county itself. It's a number of factors, and it's not
my question.
For us, it's not really clear. I've had difficulty personally getting a clear answer.
I understand that, you know, you're not a social
mm-hmm.
service agency. You're
yeah.
not the health department or anything
yeah.
like that, you know, and my background has some of that. But we're still making decisions because if you do
Understood.
A survey of your own of these communities, right at the top is too much drugs, too many alcohol outlets.
Mm-hmm.
And so the public is telling us that. And so I do believe, you know, we don't get a lot of people here who are protesting a particular permit. To me, it doesn't matter. We are still beholden to make the best decision as possible. So I'm concerned about some of those things. One would be saturation, and why is it a problem? Why would a state agency want to indicate that? Because we use it. When we get a permit and it's oversaturated, we want to ask the PD, is that okay with you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and against their better judgment, because I have asked our chief and other PD, why do you say in these reports that it's okay when you initially indicate that there's a lot of problems with violence and alcoholism or whatever in
mm-hmm.
that particular community? But I understand where it's a difficult decision, and sometimes I feel that we're okay with asking, okay, developer, you're going to do your best, keep it safe and everything else, and he says yes, and then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any other evidence or whatever. But I'm just concerned about some of those. I would also be interested in looking at other cities. I guess Fontana is similar in size as us.
Yes.
Versus how many alcohol outlets do they have? And yet they seem to be prospering. And other areas that are the same. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's good to make that comparison. When I started RBSS training for the retailers here, I don't remember. I'd have to look at my notes, but I think it was in 2003. We had 199 off sale and altogether on sale. Now we have... We actually dropped off in the off sale, but altogether we have 340 now.
Well, that's
including we're moving
the sphere
up,
as well.
But I don't think we've increased land space for the city, and I'm not sure if the population has increased.
Yeah, unfortunately,
I don't know.
I understand the comment. I that's not something I think any of us.
And I know that it's
on.
Often used either by our own department and the developers or the applicants that it is for the public's convenience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm beginning to think that that's another way of saying it is because of the bottom line, more additional sales for them, you know. And so I'm concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because going back to our own general plan, we have statements to quality of life, where families would thrive, where the safety of the public is our number one and so forth. So we want to consider some of those things in reference to that as well.
Yeah, I don't think...
So I sign up for your ad hoc.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Commissioner Lopez, I don't think we disagree with
those
a lot.
Those are just comments. Those are just comments.
A lot of the statements you're making. I think it is sometimes good to compare yourself to other cities. We don't have the staff resources to do this type of in-depth analysis based upon what Fontana does or what Ontario does. Local economics, obviously, socioeconomic issues play a large part in social issues, I think, as everybody is aware. We have tried to pull the best information we can together. Because it's in the Business and Professions Code, that means it was entirely done by the legislature. I was just talking to Stephen, and he's going to do a legislative history on this. It's my understanding that a lot of these provisions were written into the law, into the Business and Professions Codes, after the Rodney King riots, when a lot of the liquor stores in South Los Angeles were burnt down. And previously, they could have just rebuilt and gotten their permits back from ABC, and there was a lot of concern by those neighbors that they didn't want those establishments rebuilt. So that's my understanding, but if we do go forward with an ad hoc, the city attorney's office will certainly do a legislative history and do a review. The standards are there for whatever reasons the standards are, but there's also local control, and that's what the public convenience and necessity finding is for. So I think the state set the standard for, I'm sure it was a lot of horse trading, if you will, but local agencies still do have the ability to, where there are circumstances that they believe warrant an exception, and exception can be made.
I understand that the state, you know, regulates all of that, but I think the state leaves it up to the local control.
They do,
to
yes,
grant
absolutely
a permit,
and that's what the finding is for,
not
right?
To, I don't think they're going to come down on you and say, "Why didn't you grant this?"
No, and, and nothing so we're saying is that we have
I'm
to
just,
approve it.
I'm just
we
saying that.
That
the control is here, and we are beholden, and we need to understand some of those other factors that I think cross mm-hmm. into the signage, or cross into the loitering, cross into the panhandling,
yeah.
and some other things of
yeah.
that nature. And I'm not a prohibitionist, I'm not against, you know, I have a glass of wines every now and then, I've been to a brewery place, you know, that's not the case. But we do have to really look very clearly at some of these, and not...
We don't take it lightly. I mean, I think it may appear that way. We recommend approval on almost everything that comes to you because we work very hard with the applicant.
Understand.
And we tell a lot of people no. And a lot of people, if they hear that staff's not supporting them, leave. And that's why you don't get more denials. So I don't think the commission should interpret just because we're bringing you items and recommending approval that we say yes to everything.
No, and if so that's how you take it, I'm sorry.
Okay.
That's not how I meant it. Yeah. I'm just saying that with every application that comes or what you gave us is an excellent start because, like I said, I appreciate all the work because as long as I've been on the commission, I've never seen that, and we've been asking for that information. But I see it also as we still need to go a little further. We still need to have some of that information because a lot of people still think it's a personal decision whether someone drinks or not. But yet, whether it's a personal or a group or the advertising or the number of stores, I think it's pretty well researched that cities and communities have problems stemming from those things. So I'm just saying we need to look into some of those things and consider those factors.
Mark, so if I add something? Yeah. I just want to make the comment that I believe that, and I haven't run through all the police department's crime statistic numbers. Sorry, I couldn't get that out. I believe that the majority of the problems that we have in the city are related more to the deemed approved alcohol outlets, the ones that are operating outside of a new entitlement that has, you know, multiple conditions that have been updated over the last few years that they would need to comply with. So maybe one of the things that we can look at is tightening up the deemed approved or maybe becoming a little bit stricter on actually moving forward with
review. I think she's saying reviewing the compliance of those based off the operating standards in the ordinance. I think with the list that we're compiling, you know, that would definitely make that more feasible.
Bottom line is some of the proposals that I have made and Commissioner Lopez have made about asking them to buy an additional license and retire it, can't do it. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
But again, if we have a saturated census block and a new one comes in, I'm pretty sure that you're going to find that there's going to be less approvals.
I think one big thing to remember
is going to not be a very good term to use, at least for me.
I'm sorry, what was the term?
Well, I don't think we should.
For the convenience of the public and necessity.
I wouldn't prejudge applications. I think maybe the best thing to do is if the commission is interested. Again, staff's recommendation would be a two-member ad hoc. It would be with staff, Stephen, and two commissioners, and we can certainly do more research. A lot of time has been put into this, but obviously there are more questions, I think. So if the chair and commission are willing to embrace that recommendation, that might be the best way to proceed.
Yeah, I'm for the research so that we can be better informed and educated. And
if I can add one other thing.
For the decision that we have to make.
Yeah.
I have one volunteer for the ad hoc committee.
Who would that be?
Do I have any additionals? We have a sign committee. Is that the sign committee we're looking at?
We're having a meeting tomorrow.
Okay.
We actually have two. There's the sign committee and then the bylaws committee, so this would be the third. But this would be ad hoc, so it, while subject to the Brown Act, would not need to be a noticed meeting. So it makes it easier to get members together. And we don't need to. I mean, if Commissioner Lopez is the one who is obviously the most interested, we can proceed with one. It's really up to the commissioners.
I'm very comfortable with Commissioner Lopez's knowledge and depth of study on this subject.
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly do it with one commissioner, and Commissioner Lopez has been the one who's been the most interested, at least in the time that I've been here.
There you go. Right. Well, Travis, thank you very much. You and Chantel put a huge amount of effort in to getting us information because we've been sniveling about it for about 2 years.
And if I can just kind of one
I would never use that word.
Well, just kind of one closing thought on this. I mean, this is really tonight just to get, you know, we're not speaking about any projects specifically. We're just trying to give kind of groundwork information, you know, where we're at in the city. And the big thing, and hopefully it's kind of been, you know, at least alluded to, you know, at a couple points in this, is that, you know, we have police reviewing, we have other operators in the city, we have what's approved, what's not, you know, the census tracts. There's a lot of factors in this. I know we know from other projects, you know, we have a track line on the street. There's six businesses across the street, but they're not counted. And that's why we've also started, and I know Chantal took really the lead on that, was putting together, you know, better exhibits that show the larger area, you know, as aside from just the track. So even if I'm not advocating for, you know, any project or, you know, or anything, but even if we have an area, like I said, that is over concentrated, you know, there's other factors. There may be nothing within 3 miles of it because it's at the far corner of an area and all the outlets are, you know, far away. So we really need to look from a, you know, a full comprehensive perspective when we're reviewing these, and not just say, oh, it says it's over. You know, and that's it. There's many more aspects to it.
Thank you.
Yes. I believe it was the presentation or the. We can certainly get that.
Yeah, we could have it emailed.
We have it digitally. We can send it out just as we did the staff report. That wouldn't be a problem at all.
Well, let's see, we have no public, so we can skip that. Any Planning Commission reports or announcements? You're not a commissioner.
I know. with the leave of the chair, I know I'm not a commissioner. But I did just want to briefly, whenever there's been a significant development in the ongoing development of marijuana as it relates to the city, I've tried to bring it to the Planning Commission. We had Measure O, as the Commission's aware, received the highest number of affirmative votes in the presidential election that occurred in November. Staff is diligently working towards implementation of that to the extent they are able. We have received two lawsuits that were filed challenging the validity of Measure O. They were both filed on February 6th. Our office is reviewing those lawsuits to determine whether they have any merit. I do know that the proponents of the ballot initiatives intend to intervene and defend the validity of their ordinance. So we will see some development in that area. I know that the commissioners may have all seen the Sun article that came out this week regarding that. Obviously, it's ongoing litigation, so my ability to speak in depth and frankly about all those issues is limited in this forum. But if there were some general questions, I can answer those.
Was it accurate when it said that you delayed implementation of Measure O until those lawsuits are resolved?
One of the lawsuits seeks a temporary restraining order, although they have not filed the application yet. And the other is a, without getting into the legalese too bad, is a writ of prohibition, which normally would operate as a stay, but they'll probably have to file an application too. At this point, there is no order from a court that prohibits us from continuing implementation. But I expect those applications to be made shortly.
So then, if those applications will delay the implementation?
If those applications are made and if the court orders the city to cease implementation pending resolution of the lawsuit, absolutely, the city will comply with all lawful orders.
I guess that's a thank you.
Yeah.
For providing, at least providing us where more information.
Right. And I apologize. It seems like, you know, you probably read everything in the Sun that I'm allowed to say out here. So, but I did just want to, you know, bring that to the commission's attention.
Okay. Commissioner Quill.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, I apologize for being tardy. I was tied up on another project, but I wanted to make a comment. We do have that meeting tomorrow at 3 o'clock here at City Hall to review and take another look at the proposed sign ordinance changes and implications and so on. Also, I'd like to announce Friday the 24th, the Chamber of Commerce is having a casino night and the installation of its board of directors. So there's tickets available for that at the chamber, and various chamber members have tickets for it. So it's a good, fun event. So if anybody can make it, be there.
So where's that?
It's going to be held at the Orange Show at the Sports Center down there. Good event.
Okay. Any other announcements? Nope. Somebody going to move to adjourn to Wednesday, March 15th, 6 p.m., someplace?
Yes, right.
Yeah, someplace.
Someplace. Here, it's maybe. I don't know.
So just real quick on that, we will still be here in March. We will have at least 30 days notice for when we will be moving from this building. In the interim, the commission and planning commission and city council will be meeting in the 201 building, on the third floor of the 201 building. And then once the renovations start on that building, and that's probably 6 months after we're out of here to get the plans drawn and bid and the work commenced, we're looking at interim locations, if that's the best way to put it. It may be in the Sabita building at 6th and Arrowhead. There's actually a very nice conference room, so the Planning Commission may be meeting there, but that's, you know, that's probably going to be like late summer at the earliest. We will be here in March.
Then I amend it to here in March 15th at 6 p.m. All in favor? Any opposed? Thank you all again.
Yeah. You should.
That's Henry Nichols' chair. He broke it. He broke it.
Thank you.